job down at the local mill. Worked right up, not a mill is ill. I can pay my bills. The evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, took a car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't float. I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working. We're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers who do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay.
The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice, both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And we got some really interesting guests and topics today. And I want to start out right off the bat here. With a local rank and file member of a local union. Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Justice Furtado. I've been at the U of I for 21 years in the maintenance department, custodial maintenance in particular. We're represented by the Service Employees International Union, Local 73. We are particularly a chapter called Chapter 119. We had our own local here for several decades before the big shift in SEIU to basically consolidate smaller locals into bigger ones.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, that was when Stern first took over, Andy Stern, former president.
Well, it's happened in the carpenters and the laborers in recent years,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's usually not better. Yeah. It's usually not in the best interest of the rank and file. But
well, yeah, you lose your you lose some power as an individual union member.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There were some pros and cons. There were some issues that we had, you know, locally here. We really didn't have anybody to really run it, you know, as a local. So we had some financial problems and like that.
See.
There were some
mm-hmm.
things that, some advantages they had as far as fixing those problems. But like you said, the top down organization of the larger local, of the international strategy of, you know, kind of a top down management. You did feel like you no longer were part of, you know, your own local. You mm-hmm. were part of this giant hegemonous, you know, mass of, you know, everybody, you know, from all over the state.
Oh God, I know how you feel, man. That's why I as a laborer, it's just like there's just this giant weight on top of me, you know, the
yeah.
upper levels of the union. And
yeah, so anyway, you came in today because I've been seeing a lot of interesting stuff posted on Facebook about this recent endorsement by the Service Employees International Union endorsement of Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primaries. And I made a comment, and then I saw some other comments, and then all of a sudden unbelievable response from SEIU members, rank and file members from all over the country, and a lot of other rank and file members of other unions chirping and saying, yeah, our darn international did the same thing, and this is, you know, horrible. So that's why you wanted to come in today. Is that correct? Kind of talk about this?
That's it. Somebody, speaking of Facebook, you know, wonderful way for everybody to kind of organize their thoughts and you know, get together and plan things. And somebody that I think we're both connected with on Facebook contacted me largely because our chapter president, who is Aaron Ammons, we all know, you know, mm-hmm. Brother Aaron, is out of town and on business. Ricky Baldwin is our he's actually the assistant director for downstate.
Yeah, he's a staffer. Okay.
Yeah, he's a staffer for the local. Aaron and I are chapter officers.
And so you're elected by the members then?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And I'm his vice president.
Okay.
And so yeah, it's just somebody to come in here and address the issue, because as soon as we saw that, it was just immediately like, you know, I guess I'm not shocked. It's just disappointment.
Sure.
I'm not really surprised.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the AFT, IFT did that as well with their locals.
Teachers union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the teachers union, mm-hmm. when in fact they sent some anonymous, like very oddly worded email through a listserv that many of the locals didn't get. Talking about, well, we're thinking of endorsing Hillary Clinton. What do you think of this? And of course it was like a 24-hour window. And then all of a sudden we get this news story. Like people text me like, hey, you know that your international just endorsed Hillary Clinton, right? And this was months ago. And just the anger and not being able to actually have a voice in these types of decisions. I mean, this is an American trend of not respecting the workers and unions, not letting the workers drive the unions or be the central voice, you know?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, that's the reaction we're all getting. Those of you who might remember Thomas Haley.
Yeah.
He was one of our organizers down here. He actually was a BSW with me and started out the same way I did with, you know, becoming a rank and file steward and, mm-hmm. and getting into the chapter, advisory board, we call it. And then the local took him up as an organizer. The organizing team up there is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
They're a team of usually very young people. They're very driven, and they often the views I've seen with them often don't. They're not the same as say the old guard that's, you know, running things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's encouraging, I think, to see that the future of the unions, you know, are working towards, you know, more organizing and putting their efforts into that, and more progressive candidates and people like that. Everybody else in the rank and file are just doing what you expect them to do.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it's not surprising, but it's extremely disappointing, especially since, sure. You know, I get an email from SEIU the day after. Like, congratulations to Hillary. And I'm like, you know, I didn't get any notice about this at all. Nobody asked rank and file as far as I know.
Don't you think this should be voted on in each local? I mean, that they actually have a...
I think it'd be a pretty cool thing. It might increase participation by the... we can't have that.
Oh, by the members, yeah. I mean, don't you think this should be voted on local by local? I mean, they could easily do their own internal primary. I mean, you know.
Well, and that's just it. I think it's sort of like the rigged game.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Democratic National Convention, the DCCC or whoever.
The DCCC.
They've got that angle. They've got everybody, you know, I think they bring everybody in, you know, on the inside and say, let's keep this, you know, hush hush for a while, or you keep it down, you know, keeping their members in the dark.
Yeah.
Just, and saying, well, we know what's best for you.
Yes.
This is what we typically get from, you know, the politicians as well.
Yes, indeed. You know, it's really ironic, the fact that Bernie Sanders has been, you know, unequivocally supportive of the $15 now minimum wage campaign, which SEIU's been doing lots of organizing around the country, and Hillary Clinton, says, no, I don't support that. Maybe 12.
Yeah.
Maybe 12.
Yeah. That's just, again, it just makes your head spin.
Yeah,
it's astounding that on a number of issues, especially since you look at the record of Senator Clinton,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, she definitely had a lot to do with you know, her husband's policies. You know, I think they worked a lot together over the years, going back to the governor of Arkansas. You know, and
everything else.
She wasn't just his wife.
No.
She's a very brilliant woman. She's very talented.
Can't take that away from
her. She's brilliant.
She's a good debater too.
Oh yeah, but she's definitely has, you know, she realizes the same thing that the Clinton, you know, Bill Clinton and all them did, is that, you know, go where the money is.
Yep. Yep. Indeed. I couldn't have said it better, Justin. Yeah. You know, there's a history of the Clintons in Arkansas that a lot of people aren't aware of. I mean, they actually, really, devastated the, assistance to families with dependent children program there. And according to Robert Shearer, the journalist, bragged and laughed about it at cocktail parties, you know, amongst the elite.
Yeah, I mean, and we know that with Hillary, she sits on the board with Walmart, and she's very instrumental in fighting for, fighting against, livable wages for workers. I mean, this was something that Clinton also, I mean, like, I think Justice put it perfectly that they, a lot of their policies when they worked together when Bill Clinton was president, all those things are, she still has that same rhetoric. She hasn't really changed a lot of what she was saying and what Bill Clinton was saying in the 90s. And that's what she's really banking on. But if people, especially working class people in the country, remember, that was a very devastating time in this country.
NAFTA.
Incredibly devastating.
The passage of NAFTA, the signing of the World Trade Organization treaty, the passage of the China Preference Treaty, which allowed Chinese goods to be basically imported here without any kind of tariffs. Go to any store and try to find something that's not made in China. I mean, you know, I have all the sympathy in the world for Chinese workers and other workers internationally, but let's face it, China's economy has risen at the expense of our economy and our working class workers, you know.
And one can argue that it was the Clinton period when neoliberalization process was fully realized. It was started in the 70s. Reagan picked up steam and used it and really brought it and brought the idea to fruition. But the Clinton period is when it actually took plant in multiple areas and went forward into where we are today.
And also there was the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. There was Hillary Clinton's lame acting about trying to do health care reform, you know. I mean, you're going to tell me that the most powerful person in the world is going to basically be backed down by one corporate sector with one commercial? You know, come on. Please. Then there, of course, was the whole what was that bill? Where media consolidation bill, roughly. You know, I mean, I could go on and on and on about the Clinton legacy. You know, and then you know, a lot of people will say, "Well, that's unfair to her. That was him." Well, as Gus pointed out, she was very active in his administration. But not only that, just look at her record since she was a senator. I mean, let's not even talk about foreign policy, or I should maybe we should. I mean, because that's horrible. And then get back to Bernie Sanders. I mean, this is the thing is, you know, I have some differences with Bernie Sanders, but boy, I'll tell you what. I mean, what he's saying, and, you know, what he, has fought for, you know, domestically, during his career has got a lot of people excited, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. I've been following Sanders for a while. And again, it's, like you said, there are some things about him. He's not perfect. After all, he is a politician.
Yeah.
But, as far as his overall record, and especially when it comes to tackling, you know, the corporate overreach, you know, and government overreach, and supporting labor and things like that, he's been solid, and very progressive, and to see him jump into the race, you know, as a long shot, and see him get ignored by everybody. How long did it take NPR to say his name? To even mention him?
Really? I quit listening to NPR back quite a few years ago when I realized it became the Fox News, the Intelligentsia, but that's another issue.
Definitely. The only, I think, so-called liberal media guy I heard talking about him early on was, I think, Chris Matthews or someone like that, and basically was, calling him a communist or a socialist.
Really?
And unelectable. Just saying, there's no way this fringe guy could ever compete. And then we saw what he did in Iowa, and we saw what he did in New Hampshire, and we saw him
and the crowds he's
drawing
gathered.
The crowds all over the country,
Oklahoma of all places.
Well, oh my goodness!
And here's another example too. If Tom Hartman was on in markets all over the United States the same way that you have so many of these right wing people, then Bernie Sanders would be a household word because he's had brunch with Bernie every Friday for several years until Bernie started the campaign.
I think, and that's the thing too, like Bernie could have really, the major issue with Bernie that really killed him in this race is first endorsing Hillary Clinton if she wins the primary.
Yes.
And also not attacking her during debates for being one of those corporate people that he's so against. A lot of his rhetoric is about ending big corporations, going after them. But when he's on stage next to one, he gives her a hug.
Well, you know, that's been my criticism too. I've seen the first debate and I thought, you know, maybe he would get better in the second one, but gosh, I mean, he's just, I mean, he's treating her with kid gloves.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, he needs to go, and you know, a lot of, I just had this conversation earlier that, Jobs with Justice, I mean, he's like, well, he doesn't want to alienate people. Well, you got to give reason people to come out and vote for him.
Exactly.
You know, if he doesn't advocate and expose her for what she is, her, on her record, not anything personal, but her record.
And yeah, and that's the thing. People know me, they know that I'm very much so not involved, believe in American politics, but looking at the strategy of it, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are very similar, except for one thing, is that his personality or this belief that he is a socialist slash communist. That's the one thing that people recognize him for.
Well, right? Also, I mean, the domestic issues, you know.
Yeah, exactly. But my thing is that mm-hmm. if he is going to take, because the Clinton came in with the election hers already. If you're going to take it from her like Barack Obama did mm-hmm. in 2008, you have to find something that separates you from her so that people can rally around you. And one of the things that people have really been picking up on, especially with the Fight for 15 and other things, is this corporate entity that is sapping the lives out of the working people.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had picked up on that and actually attacked, we know Hillary Clinton is a big time corporate entity.
Yeah.
If he had used that in his rhetoric and actually gone after her record, then we might be talking about something different now, Hillary Clinton trying to climb back into the race, because he really could have used that fuel and changed how people view the Democratic Party.
Justice, what your take on that?
Well, definitely, and I think to put a finer point on it and to, you know, point out that you look at some of her major donors, like Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and people like that. You look the kind of people that end up making their cabinets, you know, especially their financial ministers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could expect that from Republicans. If you were Sanders or somebody running, or if you, let's go back to labor.
Yeah.
SEIU, AFT, AFSCME, you know, these big labor unions, endorsing Hillary Clinton, you know, so quickly. And they're competing against the same interests that are trying to destroy them. And now, if this was a Republican, you can understand why they're endorsing somebody, you know, who had those interests. But they're endorsing a candidate who's supposed to be on their side,
mm-hmm.
who's taking money from the very people who are going to, you know, do everything they can to thwart labor.
And labor can't win the money game. I mean, you know, they've got resources as far as money, but their real power is in their members and public relations, mm-hmm. you know, and basically face to face, door to door, and
well,
you know,
yeah.
in the streets.
It's like I. When Citizens United first happened, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking, well, the thing is, money buys you TV commercials and things like
True.
That. I suppose it can buy you canvassers also, but I don't think people really hire canvassers. I've never noticed it. But that's something that you can get from labor if you do good things for labor and you get their members excited and so on and so forth. That's where you get the phone banks. That's where you get the get canvassers. And I'm going to tell you right now, one conversation is worth 10,000 commercials.
That's true.
Of mm-hmm. course, you do have the person who's watched 10,000 hours of Fox News that you will never be able to talk to anyway. But
Yeah. Well, look at Barack Obama's 2008 campaign. I mean, if it hadn't have been for rank and file members of unions on the ground, especially in those key states of Virginia, North Carolina, and I know a lot of people went over to Indiana from Champaign-Urbana too. I mean, he wouldn't have won the election. Of course, what's he do is within 1 month after getting in office, after he promised to sign and support the card check bill, which is basically what every other industrialized union country has, is where basically 50% plus one people in a workplace sign a union certification card. Boom, done deal. You're recognized union. Union, as opposed to this horrible system we have of supervised NLRB elections that take 2 years. Meantime, the company picks off the union supporters, scares the others. And, yeah, that was the first betrayal. I mean, Obama. If it hadn't have been for rank and file members, millions of hours on the ground, he wouldn't have won the presidency. John McCain would have won.
That's very true.
And I think that's
Hillary was the, you know, she was the front runner for a while. But like you say, the rank and file really went out there and gave him, it was an upset victory because mm-hmm. Hillary was cruising.
That's true.
Until the last few parts of the primary.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she would have already been president.
Well, here's another thing too. I think the largest and the first betrayal was wasting all that time and political capital on the Affordable Care Act instead of ramming through emergency stimulative situations, much like in the Depression. And by the way, that was at that time, right before he was inaugurated. I can't remember if it was Time or Newsweek had a cover with him sort of portrayed, drawn like FDR.
Yeah.
And everybody, oh, we're all socialists now.
Yeah.
You know, and and instead they basically kind of just, socially insured that health insurance companies would have customers.
Yeah. And no, and not everybody being covered. And the main point is that health, having health insurance isn't the same thing as having accessible health care.
Yeah. Big it's sort difference. Of like, having a fire department.
Yeah. With no firemen.
Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have to work somewhere to get a fire department.
Yeah. But anyway, we got a few minutes just to wrap up here. Justice, what do you think should happen? I mean, do you want to see more SUIU rank and file members speak out on this? Is there any hints about maybe some organization and coordination going on across the country?
Well, right now, probably in the early stages, I think we've already seen it in New Hampshire with yes. SEIU Local 1984. Has officially endorsed Bernie Sanders. I think that was the first reaction was like, you know, we already knew who we wanted. Now we're going to make it official. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had a printout I forgot to bring with me, but the international spokesman, of course, very diplomatic saying, oh, we'll find a way to work it out. That's the official line. We'll see what happens down the road and, you know, if staffers are, you know, looking for work here already soon or whatever.
And I understand there's even a little bit of a revolt within the SEIU staffers, which, I mean, that's, pretty significant because, I mean, they can be fired, you know, unlike elected, officials like you in your local, elected by the members. That's really difficult unless they put a whole local in trusteeship, which takes a long time and it's a lot of effort. And it's probably not going to happen over something like this. It's usually only reserved for, you know, really extreme cases, you know. So, I mean, for staffers to even do this, I mean, that's quite, that's a lot of courage and stuff. So, Justice, I mean, let's keep in touch. And we really like to hear updates on this because I think this is a really important issue. I think this is critical, not just for the Sanders campaign and all the, excitement and enthusiasm that it's generated around the country for workers in general, but also I think this is critical for the whole American labor, the future of the American labor movement, you know.
That's for certain, and I'll definitely be on top of it. My people in Chicago, you know, definitely we'll be talking about it. We'll probably have a vote on it in January.
Oh, good.
There will be some debate, I'm sure.
Okay, very good. Thanks for coming on, Justice.
Thank you.
And we're going to take a quick music break. This is Paul Kohnheimer and Darren Druda on a song called Demo Crazy. So we'll be right back. You listen to World Labor Hour.
Formerly local people.
Okay, we'll be right back.
Very bright.
Save me. We're going demo crazy.
Okay, that was Demo Crazy, and we're back in the World Labor Hour, and we're going to be expecting a call here at 11:30 from a woman who has a program down at the community station in Carbondale. The name of the program is called Class Matters. Until she calls in, though, I mean, I know there's a couple topics we want to talk about today. So, Gus, which one would you like to start with, Minneapolis or Champaign-Urbana?
You know, Champaign-Urbana right now has become an international site of struggle over the past week. Of course, the there was a solidarity rally on Wednesday afternoon that really exploded. So many great things. You had, I mean, I'm gonna go ahead and tell you now. Yeah, it was my group, my organization. We organized it because,
what is your organization?
We formed a new group called the Black Students for Revolution.
Okay.
And what we did was it was supposed to be in solidarity with Missouri, and it was also to protest racial oppression and the treatment by the university administration against black people at the university. So yeah, what happened was it swelled to so many people. It was over 200 plus people out on the quad, and we had them screaming revolution. We had them, you know, and people came up and told me afterwards, there has never been a demonstration like that of black people at the university. Even except maybe going back into like a few times in the 60s,
yeah.
But since then, they've never seen that before. And also changing the language into what we can do with something, an idea of a revolution, meaning people taking control of their own destiny.
Because mm-hmm.
when people use the word revolution, they try to demonize it and make it to be strictly by violence.
Yes.
But all revolution means is you become a self-determinant person. You exercise your own ability, use people power to change a structure so that it's fair for all people.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would ask, did you give out any trigger warnings before this rally, and did you provide a safe space for these students?
What's a trigger warning, Bill?
Yeah. Well, a whole bunch of stuff has been coming up, man. It's like, what it is that, if you're going to assign, a book or an article or something like that, and let's say it's about some kind of disturbing issue or portrayal or something is in there. Like say there's a rape scene.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you would want to do is tell your class that there was a rape scene to warn any person in your class who may have been raped. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the type of thing I'm talking about. And it's almost come to the level of where somebody might just be offended, where I think, yeah, literature should be offensive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, well, in a lot of ways. Yeah. And there's been a lot of sort of First Amendment sort of issues coming up where a lot of leftists on campuses have been, very, I think, regressive.
Yeah.
Part of that was at Missouri, specifically dealing with a Asian American student who was a photographer and a stringer for ESPN. And I'm not sure why this was going on, but there was some sort of an encampment, and this guy would take pictures, and other people were there too, I mean, with cameras and stuff. And these demonstrators, they just got really aggressive and were actually committing assault on this person.
I think it's a little more context to this, though.
You know, but I don't know.
Now, Bill's right, though. Now, one of the problems and one of the critiques I have of a lot of student movements since Missouri is that a lot of them are liberally based. They're more so asking to work with administration more. They're asking to do things with them. Our organization, Black Students for Revolution, is clear in our mission that we will not negotiate or work with administration until students are organized first, meaning that we're not going to subvert that process and go straight to administration and try to work within the system. We're working outside the system and organizing ourselves to build a collective so that we have social capital to challenge certain things and have demands, and we're able to change those things.
Wow. Well, this is revolutionary. I mean, this is, no, I guess I'm being facetious here,
no,
because
right.
I know Black Lives Matter had a big meeting with Hillary Clinton, and it's like, as some commentators have said, they didn't even make any demands. It was just like a big love fest.
Yeah. Well, Dave, here's my concern as somebody who is a photographer.
Yeah.
And does, you know, sort of journalistic work. On occasion, you know, I just think it was ridiculous. I mean, I watched the video. It was just ridiculous the way these people were acting. First, this woman came up and like pushed on his camera.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they did, it's one thing to stand and not let somebody through, but they were pushing back.
Yeah.
But you know, that's just ridiculous. Here's another one, Dave.
Yeah.
I'm a taxpayer. I pay, I'm not in Missouri, but if this is at the University of Illinois, I pay taxes to support that. It's public property, and it's, if they want to, if they're having a demonstration, it's a, it's obviously supposed to be public. Yeah. Now, what was with these people? Why did they have to have some special place? If they didn't want to be, have their pictures taken, why don't they go home?
Well, I've heard some, another side of this story.
Was this at Missouri?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It was at Missouri, now, man. It was ridiculous. These people were, they were acting.
Can I speak?
They were acting like fascists.
Okay. I've heard another side of the story, and that is that first of all, you gotta remember, he may have been a student, but he was working for ESPN, which is a corporate news outlet, okay?
Okay, well, you know, Dave, sometimes I work for big contractors that are real jerks too.
We know how the corporate media operates, okay? And it, basically they were trying, there was something going on and they didn't want the corporate media there to try to exploit what was going on and try to spin it the wrong way. Now, I wasn't there. You weren't there. We don't know the
whole
story.
Well, Dave, it's a public place.
I don't want to get
in
this debate.
If you don't want to do things that can be photographed, you don't do it in a public area.
Can we let
if I can stand on a sidewalk and you're in your house and I can see you through your window, I can take that picture. It's up to you to pull the shades.
Okay, can I, let's let Gus finish what happened Wednesday, okay? This is an interesting topic, but we got to give Gus some time here.
Yeah, we don't mind the media presence because what we're trying to do is change the rhetoric and the dialogue that goes on campus to be more inclusive of students having the power to change things, you know. So yeah, we're not going to have that issue. We welcome the cameras and we welcome the media to come and actually, because one of the things we want to do is we want to normalize the word revolution, normalize change, normalize restructure.
Right. I wasn't saying that his group was doing that.
I know, Bill.
You know,
that's what I'm saying. So that's what our solidarity rally was all about, is that we have to change the way that we deal with racial oppression or any type of inequality on college campuses. We can't expect to work for administrations because they have a historical pattern of not listening to students unless it has to do with tuition and profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's very clear, especially in the University of Illinois' history the past couple of years, let alone the past few decades.
Sure.
So we released a press statement yesterday that details some of the things the university has done, especially in allowing a white union group that's using white supremacist tactics like taking photos and names. They actually said those things and allowed them to exist and did not condemn them right away. They talked about trademark infringement or something.
That was their big concern.
Yeah, trademark infringement. So again, the safety of the students the health and the quality of life of students on the campus has never been at the forefront for the administration, and that proved it. And it was just devastating to know that these groups can exist and actually tell people to get our information to terrorize us like the White Citizens Council used to do during the Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
So that's so that, I mean, the press release is a very tight and a very declaratory statement about what we plan to do and how we want quality of life better for all people on the campus. And that's why we're going to organize groups to do that.
Good. Excellent.
So, yeah.
And so you said this was picked up by what news outlets?
Well, yeah, this thing is international now. I've actually, you know, we talked to USA Today. In New York Daily News has something. Washington Post did a very terrible piece. None of us were able to speak to Washington Post. They just did the story on the white union.
Yeah, Washington Post.
Yeah, exactly. You knew who that was.
Yeah, I went down here ever since Woodward and Bernstein. I guess.
Well, I mean, they got bought by Jeff Bezos.
Oh,
you
okay.
know? So he's libertarian, and that's eventually going to sink all the way through that organization. And it'll
already.
Be the Washington Times all over.
Yeah,
well, but wait a minute, but I do, well, you know, I just don't really understand. And there is something that can be done. However, if I'm not somebody affiliated with the university owns the property and they can ban people. If the university would think that there are media people who are being too screwed up or something in some way, they can be banned. But as far as I'm concerned, just the way those people acted in that video was ridiculous. And if you want to have a public demonstration, you have to have a public demonstration. And you can't determine on who is going to see it and who's going to take pictures of it.
So guess what were some of the topics there at the rally?
Also, just
and I wish we weren't conflating these two things, and I'm sorry that I used your story to jump into something else, but these are two completely different issues. You want to get your point across. You want to talk to people. You want to normalize revolution. Mm-hmm. I don't know what these people in this video were wanting to do the other day.
I mean, it's like Nazis, man.
Okay,
but in terms of how big this thing has gotten now, you know, we were contacted by the international Russian news outlet and other international news stories as well. So this thing now has become, in 48 hours, it was literally 48 hours after the rally that this thing really exploded to this point now. Now we're on the front page of all these places. I mean, we're next to all these other groups that are having these protests on different college campuses. But what's different about what we're trying to do versus what other groups, and we're not trying to say that we're combating them. We are standing in solidarity. But what we're trying to do is we want to influence using revolution as a foundation for changing something and working with students to do it like an internal autonomous movement, you know, instead of co-opting to the administration that has never worked in history.
Yes.
All you get is some immediate, like some small successes, like a few percentage points of more students on the campus, and then it regresses dramatically after 1 year. I mean, you know, that stuff doesn't work. We need systemic, sustainable change, and that's what revolution brings. And that really was a lot of the conversation during the rally.
Okay.
Is that, changing, not only changing the rhetoric to revolution, but also normalizing it and making sure people understand what it means.
Mm-hmm.
Because the liberal and conservative media has done a horrible job in demonizing the word revolution, you know. And so that's our biggest thing, is for people to understand that it means you control your destiny. You use the power of community to change an oppressive structure and make things equal for all people.
Okay.
And that's what we're pushing.
Yeah, so what are some of the issues, I should say, some of the things that have been affecting African-American students at the U of I?
It's a toxic climate. And that's one of the things that the press statements charges. We're talking about a black student population, both undergrad and graduate, is hovering right around 5%.
Only 5%?
Yeah, that's how low it is. Last year, I mean, it went up a little where it was below 5%, but they did this little bump this year because we made such a fuss about it.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like a little bit above 5%. The black faculty on the campus are between 2-4% right now.
Okay.
I mean, you know, and then also too, there are so many African Americans in Champaign who cannot find work, and the university refuses to give jobs to local people. Why aren't local people, particularly the African American community who want jobs, who need jobs, given jobs to work as staff at the university? That's a major problem. That's why the culture is the way it is.
Okay. Well, and everything, not to try and set groups against each other, but just like, what is it like the breakdown with other non-white majority group, I guess you'd call some groups?
No, it's the same thing. Yeah.
Is there a lot of Asians compared to African Americans?
No,
really?
Yeah.
And you know, everybody thinks that the University of Illinois is like 50% Asian.
Well, no, the international student body, I thought you were talking about the job.
Oh,
the international student body is pretty high.
Okay, I'm talking about the whole thing. And jobs, though. How about jobs?
Well, strictly jobs, though, they're not going into the local community and getting anybody. So we're talking black and brown laborers not being used on the campus. They're going outside and getting other white people to work the campus and not letting African-Americans and Latinos get these jobs.
You know, you're talking about throughout...
Yeah, like staffers,
BSWs and the grunt work.
Yeah, exactly.
Too, all right.
During the 1980s,
basically what everybody's qualified to do.
Exactly.
Blue collar
labor.
You can't
labor.
Say that this person's too stupid to do this.
Yeah.
Right. All right.
You know, during the '80s, I did a lot of work with U of I during the summers because they'd hire a lot of the tradesmen to come over there and do remodeling projects, and I could not believe some of the people that were on us that were basically full time. Staff, I shouldn't say staff, but workers there that were carpenters, electricians, plumbers, didn't even live in the state of Illinois.
Exactly.
Much less Champaign County.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe it.
And are they from Indiana?
Yes.
And it continues today, and that's a major problem.
Oh, like, they're the people who are out there killing us on that stretch of 74 from the east.
But other things involve police presence. There's a lot of stopping African Americans, and like a few of the students even.
Oh, it's like that jaywalking thing of a couple of years ago. No, man,
not even that. They'll tell, like, one guy actually said in a meeting, like, I was walking and they patted him down until they saw his ID, and then they were like, okay, you can go on now. You know, to say that he was a student. So like, they're stopping African Americans on campus.
Racial profiling.
Yeah, racially. I mean, this kind of stuff is happening at just immense levels. And then of course, the racial microaggressions report that came out this year, they have these students telling narratives of people in class saying they're too stupid. You know, black people don't know anything. They shouldn't be in this class. I mean, the report is online for those listening. Just type in University of Illinois racial microaggressions report and it'll come up, and it shows that 39% of people of color on the campus feel unsafe and uncomfortable being on the campus because of the things that happen in classrooms, in the gym, in labs. I mean, it is a toxic environment because the administration allows this to happen. And so this is what, I mean, we have to change this, or else we're going to, not only we're going to get priced out of going to school because tuition's going up, mm-hmm. but we're also, this is going to turn back into an 1890s type school.
Yeah. I know back in the 60s, there was a lot of student activism, you know, African-American student activism, as well as anti-Vietnam War activism, of course, but where they basically made demands and got the university commit to have a certain percentage of African-Americans accepted every year, they'd be more recruited. I mean, they would be, of course, they still had to have decent grades, of course, so no one, don't even think of going there.
You know.
But, nevertheless, I think it was called Project 5000 or something.
500.
500, okay. Oh, and I heard that now the level of, the percentage of African American students at the U of I campus is lower than what was back in, 1970.
Yep.
Yeah, well, it's just bizarre. You know, I can't, because they got recruiters, one of my nephews, all my nephews have to be some kind of salesman. One of them's a recruiter for another university somewhere. And they got people that are recruiting all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just that they got to tell them to recruit some different people.
Yeah, former Chancellor Wise was very instrumental in removing recruiters from going to Chicago schools and going to Champaign schools to recruit people, and they spent recruiting from Asian countries and other international schools.
Her idea of diversity was wealthy Asians.
Yeah, from, people from out of state.
You know, from completely out of the country.
And here's the thing, and I know this from the various jobs I've worked on, from growing up in a small town around here that was completely white. And that is, I mean, there's people in that town who have had very little or no experience with any types of minorities, and they are incredibly racist, you know, and they just don't know. And it's the same way on construction jobs. When I was at that State Farm Center recently, there were actually African Americans, Latinos, and women there. And I tell you what, the conversation was much, much better.
Oh yeah.
Than when you're out there on these kind of pipe jobs and concrete jobs with a whole bunch of just white redneck guys.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick music break here, and we're going to be right back. You listen to the World Labor Hour, listen to Support Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, that was Patti Smith. People have the power.
Yeah.
A real quick public service announcement here. Tune into Labor's Worldview TV this Sunday and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. On Comcast Channel 6 and live on the net at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. And this Sunday will be the history of the International Longshoremen and Warehouse Union Workers, ILWU, the West Coast Longshoremen. Interesting story. Great film footage from the 1930s general strike. Definitely one of our gems at Labor's Worldview. So anyway, I want to open the phone lines for anyone who'd like to call and comment. It's 217-359-5483. So, Gus, what else was on your mind today?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to talk about, too, especially being in the state of Illinois, is a lot of this disgusting rhetoric that's coming from governors, particularly conservative governors, about the Syrian refugees after the Paris attacks. I mean, make no mistake. The Paris attacks were a criminal slaughter of innocent people in Paris by gunmen and suicide bombers of ISIS. But what's happening now is that these corporate people and particularly the right-wing conservatives are using the forces of militarism and empire and anti-immigrationism to push a very nasty agenda.
Okay, so we got a caller calling in, and we'll take that call here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
The James Iman Report.
Okay, Jim. What's on your mind, Jim?
691 years ago on this day,
you were born?
The Saracens ran the Europeans out of Damascus.
Okay.
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 Guys as crusaders for Christ.
Okay.
Item one.
Uh-huh.
Item two, there are 14 African countries that are still paying reparations for their freedom from France.
Like Haiti.
To Bali.
Just like Haiti,
so
huh?
Still paying. They did the same thing with Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Haiti didn't finish paying their freedom, which was the first and only successful slave uprising, until about 15 years ago. So what I learned is that money is crux to the French economy.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally they have the Foreign Legion, such as it is, spread a little bit too far. So they're going to have to start hiring mercenaries. If you think Blackwater was bad, the French Foreign Legion was even worse. I mean, they would get murders out of prison,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all you had to do was have a French lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of you, they were just all, they were all, it was a mercenary army.
Mm-hmm.
As far as what we were talking about before, about Clinton, I don't know if you mentioned that he also repealed the Glass-Steagall Act.
Yes, we did mention that, yeah.
Okay.
But that's important. Important point
yeah.
to repeat.
Right. And then there was this move to amend .org, you know, that it was affiliated with to some extent, with the occupied movement.
Uh-huh.
You know, I said, this is a waste of time. There are better things we could do, I said, at a meeting. Time. This country cannot even pass the NRA. Or the
ERA.
The ERA?
Yeah.
Okay. Equal Rights Amendment
mm-hmm.
that did Equal not pass Rights in the 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It died in the 70s in Iowa. But that would be a good thing to do anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought I'd get my 2 cents in.
Okay.
And it's been a good show. So talk to you later.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Jim. Okay, so Gus, back to what's been happening in, France and the Middle East, because they're interconnected.
Let's put this into perspective, mm-hmm. though, because what's happening is that the attacks in Paris were the work of ultra-reactionaries.
Mm-hmm.
ISIS has nothing to do with the anti-colonialist and national liberation movements that have historically challenged the world powers that have dominated the Middle East. But on the contrary, it aspires, and this is what ISIS is, it aspires to be an even cruder and more violent version of the Saudi kingdom, where a U.S.-backed dynasty uses Islam to justify violent state oppression, including the public beheadings. But here's what's happening, though. By indiscriminately killing ordinary people in Paris particularly youth, ISIS gave European powers and the American Empire a tremendous opportunity to escalate their wars at home and abroad, particularly anti-immigrationism and militarism. I mean, they literally just handed them the keys to push a very nasty, racist, and anti-immigration agenda now.
Yo, might I bring something up? Cui Bono? Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of Gladio?
Yeah, Operation Gladio, yeah.
Yeah. And also many other people thinking that, you know, isn't it kind of funny how, oh, these identity cards of one sort or another always end up being placed somehow in the scene. They're usually people who have been under surveillance by the security forces. It happens, these things happen over and over and over. Yeah. I am suggesting not so much perhaps false flag, but just letting some things happen.
But there's documented evidence on this. And also, you know, there's been stuff all over the internet, not at first, but now very credible sources showing our U.S. government, basically, helping to, you know, support ISIS.
Well, remember all the left-wing assassinations in Italy in the 70s?
Yes.
Yeah, that was all right-wing NATO Gladio people.
Posing as left-wing.
Yeah, and these people don't go away.
And of course, we're part of the Syrian civil war. We're arming the rebels to overthrow.
That's correct.
Yeah, seriously.
And you think that how come the Russians' bombing strikes are much more effective than ours are? Because we're not really trying to do anything. Exactly. And we're just trying to keep it going.
So this begs the question, why would our government do that? ISIS is so horrible. They're the enemy, but you know what?
What do you think your government's done in the past?
Well, what's the end game here? Well, in my opinion, it's basically to create destabilization and chaos in the Middle East to where it's so bad that eventually the United States can come in and say, look, we'll bring normalcy to the region, and they can put in whoever they want in power in these countries and get these international contracts for oil companies, mm-hmm. other natural resource exploiters, and let's not forget cheap labor.
But let's look at this from a historical standpoint.
Sure.
Yeah, this is a familiar pattern. 2011, September 11th attacks, the U.S. government used they used this and turned it to a pretext for wars and occupation. And it's starting with the invasion of Afghanistan, for those that are listening. Let's tie this together. The aim of this war was to capture Osama bin Laden, but to create a massive U.S. military presence in the heart of Asia. Some 14 years later, this same war, in quotation marks, drags on. And now the president of France is calling for national unity behind France's own, quote, merciless war, end quote, partly to outflank critics on his right, partly to bolster France's waning imperial power, and partly to make a bid for leadership in the European Union. So this thing is very multifaceted. Also, like the 9/11 attacks by Al-Qaeda, the Paris attacks will be used to justify a wave of repression and restriction on civil liberties, from crackdowns directly specific at Arabs and Muslims to the curtailment of freedom of expression and an increase in surveillance generally, particularly in the United States. This is all part of the process of neoliberalization.
Yes.
Whenever anything happens, all they need is one spark or one incident from a violent group that has no ties to anything politically, and they just, you know, they did what they did, and they're going to use it against people who are actually calling for democracy and calling for fair treatment to repress us.
That's part of
neoliberalism.
They'll be labeled as terrorists.
Exactly.
I mean, they're already doing that. Look at the
environment. And at the same time, you get millions of workers who are desperate and have nothing, and some of them are probably very skilled professional people, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, but look at what they've already done in this country with the environmental activist movement as well as the animal rights activist movement. Yeah. They've been labeled terrorists.
Oh, well,
even though they've never set off a bomb, never killed anybody, they destroyed some property.
Well, you know, this white supremacist group on the campus, the Illini White Union group, they called us terrorists
for
having the Black Solidarity rally on the campus when all that we mentioned was Black pride and challenging racial oppression.
Yeah.
They called us terrorists amongst other very racially derogatory names I won't say on this program, but that was one of the things, because we were just calling for more democracy and people power.
Yeah.
And all of this, like I said, this is all culminating in this toxic climate that a lot of this American militarization imperialism has caused. You know, liberation struggle.
Well, that's the thing. People that complain about not wanting to get these refugees. Well, I'm sorry, but you know what? Your government, with our tax money, created this problem. You know? And, it's our, I mean, you know what? The United States should be taking 80% of those refugees considering it was our, I shouldn't say our government, policies that created them. And, Britain and France need to take the other
20%. The Syrian civil war is caused by the United States trying to topple Assad. And the refugees are running from the U.S., dropping bombs and shooting people and giving rebels guns over there.
Yeah.
So the U.S. is causing the refugee crisis. And now you got people saying they don't want to support refugees. I mean, it's the most insane ideological just dilemma and catastrophe.
You also, too, have like the Iraqi army just kind of melts away and leaves all its equipment.
Yeah.
You know, and where are they getting the Toyota pickup truck?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is, there's been credible news sources about, you know, was a year or so ago, where there was a line of oil tanker trucks over a mile long in northern Syria lined up to cross the border into Turkey. Okay. You're telling me that U.S. intelligence satellite photos didn't see that and they couldn't have bombed them? I mean, because they're making a lot of money off this oil sales.
Yeah. Trump can kind of, they're making Trump, because he keeps saying he just bought, that's what he says he would do. Is bomb stuff like that so they wouldn't have the oil and the money.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
Well, he's just talking rhetoric to his base.
Well, I mean, but it's just really weird though, because you bring that up and that's, and they don't do that.
Yeah,
because
they've been dropping bombs out in the middle of nowhere because they support ISIS because they want to destabilize. They want to get rid of Assad, one of the last secular Arab leaders. Mm-hmm. Not a good guy. There's no argument there.
I'm going to tell you right now,
he's just not a puppet to the U.S.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah. In the Western nations, United States included, right now there are intelligence agents watching some people, and they won't rein them in. And they will allow them.
Yeah.
They may even help them.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Commit the next atrocious act of terror.
You know what? This is not conspiracy. This is, there's documented fact on this.
The state is what it is.
All this information is available online.
But from credible sources.
Is that credible sources?
Okay, we just have a few more minutes. Gus, any last words for our listeners today?
Well, you know, like I said, the big thing that we have to do is we have to stand up as people and denounce the governor's call to ban refugees, even though he legally can't do it based on his powers as governor. It's the fact that he's spreading this propaganda and saying these things when, in fact, we know that the majority of domestic terror, I mean, the overwhelming majority of terrorism is domestic based. Meaning and people born in this country.
Right wing and racist for the most
exactly.
part.
Right. So this idea that bringing in Syrian refugees, he and all these other ridiculous clowns like Ben Carson, especially him, I mean, he's just
when are abortion rights groups going to be called, abortion rights? When are those groups going to be called terrorists? Look at all the terrorism they've done. Murders, bombings.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, but PETA is a terrorist organization because they let some animals loose.
That's a great one, Bill. On that note, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on WFT Listeners Supported Community Radio Station in Champaign. And until next week, be
cute
safe.
Cute little furry animals.
Be safe and, power.
Some of them might have been mice.
Power to the people. Take care.